drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. I think we can all agree that it's been a challenging year, and in times like these, it's important to remember the happiness that life can bring. And for many of us, reading can be that joy. But if you've been struggling to get through the classics after scrolling through your newsfeed, the award-winning author Gabrielle Carey might have the story you're after. She's looked back on the remarkable life of the writer Elizabeth von Arnim in her new book, Only Happiness Here, and she's my guest in the drawing room. Gabrielle, welcome.
Hi, Patricia.
So what brought you to Elizabeth and to this project?
A very dear friend of mine who, when I was in a very flat time, she thought she would introduce me to Elizabeth von Arnim, and it was a sort of like a magic enchantment, and I immediately cheered up. So that was about 15 years ago. So I've been reading her ever since.
What got you into the actual idea of actually exploring this for your own book?
Oh, simply because she'd been forgotten. I just couldn't believe that she was so unknown, and particularly because she's Australian born, so I wanted to reclaim her for Australian literary heritage and bring the joy that I had enjoyed so much while reading her. I wanted to share that with other readers.
What was Elizabeth like as a writer? You say that she lifted you out of flat times, which is amazing. Like, I think everyone should read her then during coronavirus. What defines her work?
She's incredibly funny. So she will make you laugh out loud, and at the same time as being really poetic and, you know, just writes beautiful sentences. Her books are, not all of them, but mostly sort of old-fashioned in that they're plotted. They're plotted really well. Look, I think she's a very witty, observant writer. She was compared many times to Jane Austen when she was in her literary celebrity days, because she was a literary celebrity for many years, and extremely well-read and a best-selling author all through Europe and the US and in Australia.
And she hid fairly revolutionary ideas behind that witty tone.
A twittering bird call of protest or something. One of the commenters talk about her way of rebelling against the status of women in her times. So she does it in the really charming, funny, ironic, witty, putting pompous men down in a very entertaining sort of way. So although you can feel that there's kind of anger and resentment behind that, she does it in a way that's incredibly entertaining. And I fancy that she's a feminist of an Australian kind. She's really, well, she was just so ahead of her time. I mean, she was a feminist before really anyone really used that word.
You write that the difference between Elizabeth's books and the piles of contemporary volumes theorising about happiness is her extraordinary ability to demonstrate happiness in her novel. What does that mean to you, the demonstration of happiness?
Well, it's something I'd never, ever come upon before, and I've been reading all my life. So someone who can actually write about happiness and make you feel convinced that they're actually rapturously happy as they're writing about their experiences. Because the first two books particularly, well, all of them really to an extent are autobiographical, but the first two books in particular. And she writes a lot about the joy and the happiness that she was enjoying in her garden, particularly in Prussia at the time. And as a reader, you're just convinced, and it lifts you up. And she just, for me, became a model. This is how you do happiness. I just think it's very hard to find models for happiness, especially now. There aren't that many people around, and you look at and you think, wow, they're so happy. I want to be like them. You know, how do they do it? And Elizabeth was that for me.
Elizabeth wasn't quite convinced by the idea of marriage, was she, either before or after her marriage?
No, that's right. So when she was in her first marriage, she wrote to her cousin or whatever and saying, I don't think I can bear to be at my own wedding. So
good.
It never, she said that marriage never agreed with her, although she did do it twice. And, I mean, that's something that I could really relate to as well. I've been very bad at that as well. And having said that, you know, a lot of her novels, or if not most of them, are about marriage. And so she really is exploring that, and, again, in a really funny, sometimes sardonic way. And what I found amazing about it was just this incredible honesty about what marriage is like from the inside, you know, just really exploring it in a funny and honest way. And again, I felt that was kind of Australian, very down to earth and dead set, I guess. Yeah.
Her suspicions were rather warranted though, weren't they? The first marriage wasn't exactly blissful.
Well, you know, there's really two sides of that. She called the first husband, she nicknamed the Man of Wrath. And so in her first book, she just refers to him all the way through as the Man of Wrath because he was obviously wrathful a lot of the time. But, I mean, he read the manuscript before it went to publication and he allowed that to go to publication. So in the days where you had to get permission from your husband for everything. And so, you know, I think he was a grumpy, much older husband, but also I think he was quite indulgent and let her sort of more or less do what she wanted. So I think there was some affection there, but it was with the second marriage that was really disastrous. But she got out of that quite quickly.
What happened there?
Well, she she just got out of having this affair with H.G. Wells, which everybody did, I think, in those days. And she was getting over that. So I think she was in a bit of a rebound. And Bertrand Russell's brother walked in and he was tall and handsome and he was an earl. So she liked titles. And he just decided that she was the woman for him. And she seemed to lose her will and not be able to. She just felt it was her fate, her doom, she called it. In walked my doom. So her second husband was her doom and she just fell into his plans. I mean, after they met, he went straight back to London and divorced his then wife and just, you know, wrote to Elizabeth and said, right, I'm ready to get married now. Look, my suspicion is actually that they had a fantastic sex life. So I think that's really, I don't think the sex life in the first marriage was very good at all. And I think she had, you know, she had discovered that sex could be really wonderful. And so that's my theory about what happened with the second husband.
I'm going
but then
with it.
Then he turned out to be a philanderer and a drug addict and a gambling addict and a tyrant.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Gabrielle Carey is my guest in the drawing room and we're talking about her new book, Only Happiness Here. So Elizabeth writes that the first principle for happiness is freedom, but freedom was a rather complicated thing for a woman at that time.
Well, it sort of didn't exist, really. Particularly
so complicated that it wasn't even existent, yes.
Yeah. I mean, well, she was in Prussia and so it was a German-speaking country and she describes really well the male attitude towards women then and, you know, they were just like poodles or something, you know, and you were owned and, for example, when she had her first book was a huge bestseller and she earned, you know, equivalent of £500,000 or something within the first year of it being published. And that money went straight into her husband's bank account. Like she had no power over that. And she also had no power over her children. I mean, if she had decided she wanted to separate, she would have lost her children. And so, yeah, essentially no freedom whatsoever, which is why she went, they were originally living in Berlin, and she insisted she wanted to go and live on the in a country house with all this acres of gardens around. And in that way she got freedom, because she was outside of the very, very stuck up and restricted society of Berlin in those days. But I guess that word freedom is a bit tricky, and I think sometimes I should have I think it's autonomy now. I mean, freedom is a bit vague, isn't it? It's a bit amorphous. And I think what's at risk now in our contemporary times is more a sense of autonomy. So I think those two things are very important for happiness.
Elizabeth's first books were published anonymously at her request. When did that change? Why did she decide to become public?
I think that changed when her husband died. So, again, you can't imagine how the attitude towards women writers in those days was appalling. They just, and also because she was in this aristocratic society in Germany, where you couldn't be a woman writer and be in that society, partly because it meant that you were earning money, and that was really seen as below your station. And just having being a public figure, you just couldn't be that. And also, I think because she was such a bestseller, she was immediately also translated into languages, many other languages. And the only language she refused the translation for was into German. So she didn't want her class and her neighbours and her friends and relatives aware that she was doing this. So it was a huge secret. Then her husband died and she went back to London and she was liberated. And by then her identity had come out and she had become this London celebrity, and I think she quite enjoyed that then. In fact, you know, until that point she was using her real name, which was Mary. And then she, when her husband died, she actually took on her pen name as her real name.
Elizabeth had these sometimes very difficult relationships, possibly struggled with depression. How then do you think she managed to embody happiness? Was it how? How do you sort of look happy when you're maybe not so happy?
Oh, I don't think she ever pretended to be happy when she wasn't. I mean, she had a life of extremes. And I actually get the impression that a lot of people who can experience intense happiness also experience intense depression. I mean, you think of a lot of comedians, for example. You think Spike Milligan's a really great example of someone who suffered from really black depression, but also had these amazing, you know, highs and could be, you know, was one of the funniest people that ever walked the planet. So I don't want to pathologize. I don't want to suggest that she was bipolar or went from, you know, one from manic to low. I just think that because I think her depressions were in response to real restrictions and difficulties that she had, bearing so many children and trying to have a career as a writer and putting up with the husbands. So it was reasonable that she be depressed. But then she had this capacity, which I think from the research that I've done was pretty much something she was born with. She seemed to have this wonderful, light, enchanted sort of outlook on life, where she had a capacity for happiness and enjoyment that people always marveled at. You know, people that met her just and that's why they swarmed around her. She was hugely popular. You know, people always wanted to have her to their dinner parties or go to her chalet to stay with her because she was such great company.
You said that you'd consider Elizabeth a feminist, but she didn't want to be part of the suffragette movement. You write that Elizabeth's objective was happiness, and people who lived for their principles, she'd noticed, were not happy. It's true, actually. People often who are fighting for difficult things are not that happy. That's because they're in touch with reality, right?
Well, I don't think you wouldn't say Elizabeth wasn't in touch with reality.
No, but that idea that, you know, if, obviously if you are very aware and you're fighting against an oppression, you know that oppression can be quite hurtful.
Yeah, I guess, look, a couple of things I can say there. Look, my father was this great, you know, fighter against oppression and, you know, anti-Vietnam War activist and a political activist all his life. Ended up very miserable, ended up suiciding. And he was the most principled man I've ever known. And I guess for me personally, I have noticed that when people become obsessed with, I don't know, causes and like the suffragette movement or whatever the equivalent might be now, is there isn't much room left in their lives for joy. And in fact, they get into the habit of thinking that if I take some time off and enjoy myself, I'm not doing what I really should do to make a difference in the world. And they kind of start feeling guilty about having some pleasure in life. And I just think that's really an unfortunate thing to happen. And I think it's a sort of a thing that we live now with, sort of a fashion, it's a way of being that we have, that an approach to life that we have, that I don't know if that's good.
You said that everyone wanted Elizabeth at their parties and she was great company, but her favourite company were dogs.
Ah, yes, because they loved her unconditionally, unlike men who were very unreliable. Mm. Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, yes, and particularly towards the end of her life when she'd given up on husbands completely. Yes, and that I have to say that that's part of her personality that I cannot relate to whatsoever. It's not that I dislike dogs. I love them and like them, but I wouldn't make them the centre of my life the way she did. Although I have to recommend her book called My Life with Dogs or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Is one of her favourite, you know, one of my favourites and one of her funniest. It's a very funny book.
You spent a year researching this book on a fellowship. What was that year like for you? It sounds like it was kind of a nice chance to step away from normal life.
It was sublime, Patricia. I mean, honestly, I got up every day and I just thought, I can't believe how happy I am. And this is, I'm alive and the sun's shining. And I look, this is, you combine with the fact that I didn't have to work. I was only working at what I wanted to do. I just did exactly what I wanted to do every day. So I had an incredible freedom. I had a wonderful network of friends and colleagues that really supported my project and were really interested in Elizabeth. And it was just fun because just finding out things about her and rereading her books and finding other people who are passionate about her. And, yeah, I mean, she's just a fun person to spend time with.
What should we take from Elizabeth in this year where happiness is perhaps in short supply?
Well, look, what can I say except, you know, encourage people to go and read her books and just it is possible to be happy. I'm not saying be happy from the moment you get up to the moment you go to bed 7 days a week. That's not going to work. But when I started out on this project, I actually didn't believe in happiness. I was very cynical about that word.
Fair enough.
And I'm not anymore because I'm not. And I think it's a good thing to be, isn't it, Patricia?
Oh, if you can give it a red hot go, absolutely. Go for happiness for sure. So if you can only read one of her books, is it the dogs one? Which one should
No, I think the first one I would recommend is something called The Enchanted April, which is based on a real incident in her life where she goes off for a month and she just decides she's going to have a happy month. And it's a funny, uplifting, warm, gorgeous book. And there's also two film versions of it. So if people can't be bothered reading it, there's a gorgeous 1992 film version and another one, a black and white one from 1935. So there's three ways of enjoying The Enchanted April.
Well, you've suggested that people should read Elizabeth's books, but they should definitely track down yours as well. Gabrielle Carey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Patricia. I've just had so much fun talking about Elizabeth with you.
I know. I feel happy. Who would have thought? Gabrielle Carey has been my guest in The Drawing Room. Her new book, Only Happiness Here, is out now through UQP.